5 days. Nearly 20 airlines, both local and foreign, have been affected, and Seoul's Korea Communications Commission says the jamming signals appear to have come from the north. Officials said scores of commercial flights were forced to use an alternate system, and so far no damage has been publicly reported. The country's Ministry of Defense says no military transportation has been disrupted either. North Korea recently threatened to attack the south using special actions that would last several minutes. For NPR News, I'm Doahli Saikautau in Seoul.
The FBI is alleging that the five Ohio men charged in a bomb plot this week placed what they believed were real explosives beneath the main bridge near Cleveland. Authorities say the suspects repeatedly tried to detonate the devices using cell phone text messages, except the bombs were fake, courtesy of an undercover agent. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now presenting the retrospective Cindy Sherman. More at MoMA.org.
Come sort through thousands of CDs, DVDs, tapes, and albums, plus stereo equipment for sale at Vintage Vinyl this Saturday at our new site located at 1803 Philo Road in Urbana, directly north of the Hot Slots Racing Store. Proceeds benefit the Illinois Radio Reader. For sale hours, visit WILL.illinois.edu. That's WILL.illinois.edu.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Most Americans have no idea what the federal government does for them, which leads many people to believe that, in fact, it does nothing. If you put that together with the reality we have now in politics, where we have two parties that seem to be completely unable to work together to solve our big problems, all that means that we are headed for a future where almost everyone will be hurt. At least that's the fear, and that is the argument of a new book that we'll be talking about this morning on Focus. The title of the book is White House Burning: The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You, which is, in large part, an exploration of the national debt, what it is, where it came from, why we should worry about it, and what we should do about it. And our guest for this hour of the show is the co-author, one of the authors of the book. His name is James Kwok. He is associate professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law, and is the co-author of the book along with Simon Johnson, who is at MIT's Sloan School of Management. And the two of them were authors of a previous book. And in fact, we talked about that book on the show. The title of that book, 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover, and the Next Financial Meltdown. This was a book that takes a look at the rise of the financial sector over the last 30 years and the role that it played in on the recent financial crisis. So if you're interested in that, you can look at that book. That interview is still on our website. And of course, if you'd like to read the new one, White House Burning, it's published by Pantheon, and it is out now. Questions, comments are welcome in this hour of the show. We ask only that people try to be brief so we can keep the program moving along, get in as many people as possible. But questions and comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk, willtalk@illinois.edu. And Professor Kwok, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me, Dave.
Well, thank you for being with us again. We appreciate it. You know, the subject of the problem of the debt and what we should do about it, very much a topic of current conversation. I expect it to be something that our candidates here in the election will be talking a lot about. But the event that the title refers to is something that happened 200 years ago, in the War of 1812, when the British burned Washington. Why start there?
That's correct. So the War of 1812, as you might have realized, began exactly 200 years ago this year. The declaration of war was in June, so next month will be the anniversary. I don't think there will be a lot of celebration. There's not a lot to be proud of in this war. It basically ended up as a stalemate with Great Britain, and it's not clear we should have gone to war in the first place. We chose this as the example because we think it's a vivid demonstration of what can happen when a country is unwilling to pay for the policies that it wants. So in this case, what happened was that, just to go back in time a little bit, in the 1790s, we had the first government under the Constitution. Alexander Hamilton was the Treasury Secretary. He restructured the national debt and also imposed a number of taxes, and the Federalist Party went on a campaign, relatively modest campaign, of building up the military. In 1801, the Democratic Republicans, led by Thomas Jefferson and later James Madison, came to power, and they were the party of small government and low taxes. So they cut taxes, they cut back on the building program. Fast forward a decade, and we were having various tensions with Great Britain over a set of issues, and eventually James Madison decided to ask his party, the Democratic Republicans, who were a majority in Congress, to declare war on Great Britain. And his Treasury Secretary, Albert Gallatin, asked for certain tax increases in order to pay for the war, because he knew that in order to borrow money, he would have to have tax revenues to back them up. And the majority faction in Congress, called the War Hawks, this is where that term comes from, mm-hmm. voted for war but declined to raise taxes to pay for it. And the result was that throughout the entire war, the United States had difficulty supplying the army and building enough ships to fight the Royal Navy on the seas. And for a variety of reasons, notably the fact that Great Britain was distracted by fighting Napoleon in Europe, we were able to essentially fight this war to a stalemate. But the low point was definitely in August 1814, when the British landed in Maryland, waltzed across land to Washington and burned every official building in the city.
Mm. Well, I think, you know, what's really striking here is, again, it goes back, and it does indeed go back, I think, to all the way to Alexander Hamilton, that now people seem to, they're very concerned about debt, and certainly they should be concerned about the national debt because it's so big. But it seems that that might lead people to say, well, debt in any respect is bad. And it seems that what Hamilton argued for, and something that really worked for a long time, was he said, look, there will be emergencies where you'll have to raise money, and a war would be an example. And he said, look, that's okay. It's okay in that case to go out and borrow money. But the important thing is that after the crisis is passed, then you have to bring down that debt. And then he would, I'm sure, go further to argue that, and, you know, you need revenue to do that, and maybe you have to have taxes to generate the revenue. And, you know, as long as you pay down, you know, work off the debt afterwards, you're going to be okay. And that apparently worked pretty well for a long time, really until only the last, I don't know, 10 years or less. What happened now within the relatively last few years to make this business of, you know, financing emergencies by debt, what caused this whole thing to collapse?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, so from the War of 1812, we had another major increase in the national debt in the Civil War, World War I, and World War II, and each time we were able to pay down the debt afterward. The last 30 years have been different for a couple of reasons. You know, I can give you essentially the Republican and Democratic perspectives on that. The Republican perspective would be that the government has changed. So right now, it used to be that the government was largely the military. And for a long time, the government, most federal spending was either the military or was pensions for Civil War veterans. Now the government engages in a much wider array of activities. You said at the top of the program that a lot of people don't know what the government does. I mean, one way to think about it, some people say the federal government is like an insurance company with an army. So mm-hmm. we have the national defense, but mainly what we provide are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Those consume a large part of federal spending. So one reason is simply that the range of activities the government engages in expanded greatly. But the other reason, I think, is that over the past 30 years, to give you, let's call it, the Democratic perspective on this, is that we have had a very successful tax revolt in this country. So taxes have been in the news a lot. It's not a topic a lot of people get excited about, but it's been in the news because of Mitt Romney and other reasons. Taxes before the 1970s, the top tax rates were above 70%. President Carter brought them down to 70%, and President Reagan brought them down to 50% and later 28%. we used to have a country where it was accepted that in order to get the government services people wanted, such as Social Security and Medicare, we had to pay for them. This is essentially, you know, the same question that the country faced before the War of 1812. If you want to have a war, you have to pay for it. And then in the past 30 years, the Republican Party has shifted from being what was widely considered the party of fiscal responsibility into the 1980s to a party that essentially focuses entirely on cutting taxes all the time, regardless of the impact on the deficits. So the turning point, you could say, wasn't the 1980s. We talk a little bit about David Stockman, who was President Reagan's first budget director. Stockman was someone who wanted to cut taxes, but he also wanted to cut spending drastically to pay for those tax cuts. The tax cuts happened. The spending cuts never happened. And that's something that's been repeated again under George W. Bush, obviously. So what we have is a political system where essentially you have either a majority or a blocking minority called the Republican Party, which refuses to raise taxes under any circumstances. And as our population ages, as healthcare becomes more expensive, that is just creating this growing gap between government spending and government revenues.
Yeah, I really do like that. You know, whoever the wag was who coined that that expression that the United States is an insurance company with a really big army, I like that a lot. And in fact, that's a pretty good statement of where we are, and that we're coming to realize perhaps more and more about the costs involved in running the big insurance part. We certainly are aware of what it costs to run the army part too, and it seems that so we get to the point where we don't have much discretionary spending anymore because so many things are committed to the social programs, and you know, one I guess can argue about how discretionary military spending is. And I know that you and Simon Johnson argue that we do indeed need revenue. And that you argue that the Bush tax cuts should not be allowed to expire, as they will do if nothing is done. So, but I guess I come back to the idea of the army, the insurance company with the army, and whether in fact that's sustainable, and where the possibility for what sort of possibility there is in fact for reducing spending on either sides of that equation.
Yeah, so at the beginning of the show, again, you said a lot of people don't know what it is that the government does. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, we have a lot of anti-government sentiment in this country, a lot of anti-tax sentiment, and part of that is because people don't really know what... it's funny. On the one hand, they don't know what the government does with their money, and I think a lot of people have the image that there are just, you know, huge concrete office towers in Washington and in the Virginia suburbs filled with bureaucrats who are making their lives more difficult. And that is one image of the government that has been promoted. As you pointed out, if you look at the actual dollars, two-thirds of all government spending now is a category called payments for individuals. So that means either checks sent to people, that would be Social Security checks, or, for example, reimbursements for health care, that would be Medicare and Medicaid. So that is essentially what the government is doing. And an important point that I think people should bear in mind is when you cut government spending, you're essentially cutting payments for individuals. You're taking money out of people's pockets. It's the same as a tax increase in that sense. The only question is whom it affects, and so this is really a distributional question. But to get back to your question, I think the real issue we face is that, you know, one thing we wanted to say, which in a sense is obvious, is that we can't have our cake and eat it too. We can't have the lowest taxes in the advanced industrialized world and also have, you know, essentially unlimited health care for the elderly. And, you know, what I personally believe is that we need the social insurance programs we have, especially Social Security and Medicare, because if you think about it, if we cut Social Security, is easier to think about, so let's think about that. If we cut Social Security benefits, you're just taking money directly out of the pockets of the elderly. Mm-hmm. And that may make the federal budget look better. It may make the deficit smaller, but it's not making the American people as a whole any better off. If you think about it, we're just shifting the deficit from, you know, the Office of Management and Budget in Washington, we're shifting it from them onto individual families. So that's our opinion. So I think that one thing we try to show in the book is that it is possible to sustain our social insurance programs in more or less their current form, if we're willing to make other hard choices. But I guess the more fundamental thing I would say is that I understand that some people do not want to raise taxes and want to instead reduce our social insurance programs, and that is a coherent response to our situation that, in a sense, I respect, although I disagree with. What I do not, I think the problem we have in Washington is that the current course and speed is to continue cutting taxes without cutting spending, and that is not a solution. Mm.
Our guest in this part of Focus is James Kwok. He is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Connecticut School of Law. He is also currently a fellow at Harvard Law School Program on Corporate Governance. He is the co-author with Simon Johnson of the recent book White House Burning, and it is about the national debt, and it's published by Pantheon. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I appreciate some of Simon Johnson's contribution in this documentary Frontline did last night, 4 hours on the financial crisis. There was something that I already forgot that I disagreed with, but his contribution to the discourse is great, and I'm sure yours is as well. I particularly appreciate him calling out the fact that we've already had a coup in the country, which was a bit controversial, and I don't know whether you have a position on that. But the idea that the U.S. is an insurance company with an army is intriguing, but roughly half people get some kind of government insurance, I think it is, if you add everybody up. But the other part of it is what's driving up the health care costs. It's not the delivery of health care. It's in some cases the non-delivery. This is the old argument about all of the waste and abuse in the corporate sector of health insurance. Sector and on big pharma as well. So if that could be arrested, the curve would naturally come down and we wouldn't have to be worrying about it. In fact, there are some people that argue, I think credibly, that there would be no problem looking forward at an increase in the national debt if healthcare costs were just in line with some other countries. There's actually a calculator on the web that does that for you, reprograms our expenses and shows what effect it has on the deficit in the long run. So none of that's a question, but I wanted you to react to it. But I also, there are a lot of, these hard choices that you were just referring to about maybe Social Security even. It's not that hard of a choice if you could just get political momentum to actually just take away the cap so that Bill Gates doesn't pay the same amount as somebody making, $104,000. Dollars of tax into Social Security, but then it's a full-fledged actual Social Security system and can't be regarded as an insurance system. So I don't know. It just seems like there's an awful lot of misrepresentation, and Peterson Institute spends a lot of money framing the issue in very unhelpful ways. And I don't know. I think Johnson is now affiliated with the Peterson Institute, so I hope they get him a free hand.
Okay.
Professor Kwok, for some reason you're kind of breaking up on us there, and I don't know if we're going to have a problem here with your line, and possibly we might have to put the call through again. Try again to say something for us. And now I think we've lost him completely. Okay, we'll put the call back through again, and we'll get back to it here again. Well, that'll just give me the opportunity to reintroduce the guest. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we are talking with James Kwok. He is Associate Professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law. He is the co-author, along with Simon Johnson, of a new book. The title is White House Burning, and it is about the national debt and what it is and how it got to where it is and what we should be doing about that. The book's just out now. It's getting a lot of attention. It's published by Pantheon. James Kwok and Simon Johnson, they're also the authors of an earlier book that's titled 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover and the Next Financial Meltdown. This is a book that we actually discussed on this program with James Kwok. It's about the history of the financial sector in the United States and the role that it played in the financial crisis of 2008 and onward. That interview you can find on our web archive. And, of course, if you'd like to read that book, it is available as well. We'll go back here again to our guest, Professor Kwok. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Good. Okay. I'm not sure what happened there. Anyway, I'm glad.
Okay. So a lot of great points. I wanted to cover them quickly. First, I should say Simon is a fellow at the Peterson Institute on International Economics, which is from the Peterson Foundation, just as an aside. So I'll come back to healthcare. On Social Security, I think, in the book we
I'm sorry, Professor Kwok, whatever the problem is, we're having the same problem again, and it makes you impossible to understand. We'll are getting our engineer on it, and we'll see if we can get that problem here taken care of, because we really want to hear what you have to say, and if it's going to sound like that, we're not going to be able to do it. So, but again, we welcome people into the conversation here. 333-9455. That's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also send in a question or a comment by email. If you would like to do that, that's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, we'd certainly welcome you into the conversation. Just a quick mention that tomorrow morning on the program, we will be doing our regular monthly show on computers. This is something we've been doing for a long time, and we built it into the schedule because we figured people would always have questions about computers and computer problems. Peter Kimball will be our guest tomorrow. He's generally on every other month, and he's computer-assisted instructor specialist with the Center for Teaching Excellence at University of Illinois. So this is a chance to do a little troubleshooting. You know, maybe your computer's just... it's doing something that it shouldn't, or you're having a difficult time getting to do what it is that you want, and you need a little bit of advice. Or, you know, maybe it's time to get a new one, and you're thinking about how to make that decision. Any and all of those kinds of questions, they'd be welcome with Peter tomorrow morning in the 11 o'clock hour. We will try again here with our guest. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought we were ready to go here. We're putting the call through again. So then let me tell you that Friday morning at 10 o'clock, our guest is Gary Allen Fine. He's a sociologist and director of graduate student affairs at Northwestern. He'll be talking with us on the topic, The Global Grapevine, Why Rumors of Terrorism, Immigration, and Trade Matter. He'll be actually with us here in the studio. And then we'll finish up the week with our monthly show on dog care and behavior. And dog trainers Jim Keel and Carol Lindholm will be with us. You can check the schedule by going to our website. That's will.illinois.edu. Okay, now we're trying again. Professor Kwok?
Thank you.
All right. Well, hopefully we'll go on here uninterrupted for the rest of the show. And can you make some response to what the caller had to say?
Yes, I can. So the point about healthcare is very valid. I mean, I think we spend about 17% of GDP on healthcare. The average for industrialized countries is about 9%. If we could get that down, that would solve all of our government's fiscal problems for a long time. Essentially, the point that Simon and I want to make is, you know, I subscribe to the belief that our overspending on healthcare is largely due to bad incentives in the industry. So, you know, the overtreatment incentive for doctors to order too many tests because of the way we pay for healthcare. That said, Simon and I are not going to come up with a magical solution to the healthcare problem while other people have failed. So our attitude is essentially we should try to solve that problem, but we can't assume that we're going to solve it either for political reasons or other reasons, and therefore we have to be prepared for a world where healthcare continues to be expensive. And then secondly, I wanted to say about Social Security, I agree that there are actually many ways that one could fix Social Security. We propose increasing the cap on taxable wages significantly, although not eliminating the cap. But in the longer term, as the caller I think noted, healthcare is actually the larger problem. So Social Security is, let's say, a little bit out of balance in the long term, but Medicare is very much out of balance. And that is where we either need to cut spending or figure out a way to pay for Medicare.
Yeah, all right. Let's talk with another caller. We have someone in Kankakee on our toll-free line. This is line 4. We'll go there. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Great program. I was wondering, David, perhaps your guest could comment. There was a program this week, NPR, On Point. I don't remember the gentleman's name. I'm sure your guest knows him. He's from Princeton. He's the economics professor at Princeton. And his point is basically to say that we're in a depression now, and what needs to happen is government needs to spend and spend big time And to heck with inflation. He says we don't need to be afraid of inflation, even if it gets to be 4%. But we certainly don't need to make cuts, tax cuts. And that's really basically a political agenda being pushed by the Republicans. And I was wondering if maybe your guests could comment on that. Thanks.
Okay.
Sure. So I'm sure that was Paul Krugman.
Yes, it was Paul Krugman. He was just on Monday, I think it was. Yes. Sure.
And so Paul Krugman, I have a great deal of respect for him. He, you know, his position, I think, along with many other Democratic economists, is that right now the biggest problem the country faces is unemployment and slow growth. And what we need to do is stimulate the economy to get more jobs. And I actually agree with that. I think that, you know, in 2012, that is the biggest problem we face, because if we do not get economic growth going, then the debt problem will be even worse. I think that the debt problem is, in a sense, the problem we're going to face for the next decade, if not longer. And I think we need to be talking about how to address that problem. I also think, you know, on the topic of tax cuts, you know, so people like Professor Krugman think that we should be, you know, extending at least some of the Bush tax cuts so we can stimulate the economy. We should also should be spending more. We should be running big deficits. I would be comfortable with those policies if I had confidence that our government would be able to undo them, let's say in 3 or 4 years when the economy is growing strongly, and then restore budget surpluses to pay for those deficits. I'm not confident in the ability of Congress to, you know, spend now and save later. So I'm not certain that that we should be adding large amounts to the deficit right now. But from a theoretical perspective, I think he's right.
You do. I think that you and Simon Johnson do indeed make some proposals, long-term proposals for reducing the deficit. But I wonder whether you think, and it's something that I think you talk about doing over quite a long period of time, and that whether we, some people have are making the mistake in not in saying that we should reduce the deficit, but in trying to do that more quickly than we really need to do it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a difficult question to address. Our position is, it's interesting because we wrote a book which says White House Burning in red letters on the cover, and it talks about the national debt.
Mm-hmm.
But we are not, I would say we are not at the alarmist end of the spectrum. There are books out there about the national debt that talk about bankruptcy and, you know, the world ending and so on. And we actually think that in many circumstances, running deficits is a fine thing to do. And we agree with Alexander Hamilton that often it makes sense to have debt. We think that if you look 10, 20 years out, we probably have too much. And we probably have too much because the world is going to change. So right now, the United States has this enviable position that despite all of our problems, we can borrow money incredibly cheaply. And we think that's going to change for a number of reasons, global reasons, that I can get into. But we think that means we probably have, you know, 10 or 20 years to get our house in order. And that's why we think we have time. We don't need to slash spending right now when unemployment is still over 8%. So really what we're trying to outline is a set of proposals that can be implemented over the next 5 to 10 years. And we think that that will, according to our projections, that will bring the national debt under control in the time window we have. Now, obviously, we can't see the future perfectly. Things could go bad faster than we anticipate, but again, there's a risk of overreacting and raising taxes and cutting spending too rapidly at the same time.
Our guest in this hour of focus is James Kwok, and we're talking about a book which he co-authored that's just recently out. The title is White House Burning. We have some other callers. We'll talk some more in a moment after a very short break. This is Focus.
Investigative journalist Steve Call has written extensively about Afghanistan and Pakistan and the uses of government power. In his new book, Private Empire, he turns his attention to ExxonMobil and its power and influence. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Steve Call. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Burlingame Home Inspection and Performance. Burlingame performs property inspections along with energy audits and ratings for Energy Star, tax credits, and efficiency mortgages, all utilizing infrared technology. More information is at CUSaveEnergy.com or 217-649-1173.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. The easiest way to check the schedule is to go to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. That way you can also listen to past programs. You can follow us on Twitter as well, Will Public Media, and we're also on Facebook. In this hour of Focus, our guest is James Kwok. He is associate professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law. He is the co-author, along with Simon Johnson, who teaches at MIT. He's at the Sloan School of Management. The two of them are the authors of the book White House Burning, and it is just out now from Pantheon, and it is about the issue of the national debt and how we should think about that. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller, another caller to bring in Effingham, line number four. Hello.
Well, I've changed my question. Your guest just made a statement about in the future the world is going to change, and if he could elaborate on that, that's my question. Thank you.
All right. I guess that specifically, I think what you were talking about was in the ease with which at attractive rate the United States can borrow money. I think you're saying that's the thing that's going to change.
Yeah, because if you think about it, if you can borrow money and not pay interest, you might as well borrow as much as you can. And if you know that you're never going to have to pay interest, you can just borrow infinite amounts of money and continue rolling over the debt every year. And right now, the United States can borrow money essentially at a negative interest rate. And so if we knew that situation was going to hold forever, then we would not have to worry about the national debt at all. So we have to think about why is it that we can borrow money so cheaply? And there are essentially two reasons. One is that there are lots of people in the world right now who want to save money, largely China and emerging market economies in Asia, and also oil-exporting countries. When oil is expensive right now, they are accumulating large amounts of money. They want to save it for the future. And then so the second half of the equation is right now, if you want to save money for the long term, what do you want to invest it in? And the answer, the universal answer from central banks around the world is U.S. dollars or assets that are denominated in U.S. dollars, like treasury debt. And that is because, you know, this is the country where you know that when you'll be able to get your money out if you need to, as opposed to, for example, China. And also it's, you know, the only viable competitors, let's say, to the U.S. dollar are the British pound and the euro, and Europe is in considerably worse straits than the U.S. right now. And that's why during this financial crisis and during this recession, the interest rates that we pay to borrow money have only been going down. So what's going to change? Well, in the long run, two things are going to change. One is that a lot of these emerging market economies like China are going to start consuming more and saving less. So when China becomes more of a middle-class country where people consume more instead of saving it all for retirement, China is just not going to have as much money that it's not going to need to invest overseas, so they will not have as much appetite for treasury bonds as they do now. And then secondly, we have to assume that other parts of the world will get their act together. So we don't know exactly what's going to happen to the Eurozone, but it's quite possible that 10 years from now there will be a euro or there might be a Deutschmark, which is considered by global investors to be a better store of value than the U.S. dollar. So we think that right now our fortune situation is a product of some, you know, some historical factors that are not going to last. So to the question of what's going to change that will make it harder for us to borrow money, that's the short answer.
Okay. We have someone listening, obviously listening online. They're calling from Seattle. This is line four, the toll-free line. Hello.
I have a question kind of related to the budget crisis caused by tax cuts, something you don't hear people talk about. But in addition to tax cuts, it seems to me that maybe, you know, 30 years ago, people could have planned a budget for a state or the country and said, okay, we expect 50% of the people to stay ahead of inflation, and so we'll anticipate having this much money. But what happened instead is none of those people or 1% of those people, you know, actually did stay ahead of inflation. And so rather than just tax cuts causing it, it was mispredicting the already, you know, rising inequality in income, and that actually creates its own kind of deficit. You never hear anyone talk about this, but it seems like that must be happening, and I just wondered if you could comment.
So I think that, you know, rising inequality is a major reason why we need to keep our social insurance programs as opposed to jettisoning them. So Social Security, the average benefit for Social Security right now is about $13,000 a year. So nobody is getting rich off of Social Security. And if, you know, if we had more widely spread income growth, and if we had, you know, if we had a private retirement system that worked, as opposed to 401ks, which have all sorts of problems I can get into, if anyone's interested, then Social Security would not be as vital. But right now, I think, I'm not certain, but roughly two-thirds of Social Security, for roughly two-thirds of Social Security beneficiaries, Social Security is our main source of income. So this is one reason why I think it's important not to simply gut our social insurance programs because of the high deficits we face today. At the same time, I think that, you know, if you look at increasing inequality over the past 30 years, there are many, many causes of this, many arguments people have given. I think one of them has to be the tax cuts themselves. So the tax cuts we've had have disproportionately favored the wealthy, and I think the tax cuts themselves are one reason why we have so much inequality today.
Does that, I don't call it, did you?
An additional factor.
Yeah.
And that is that if you're planning a budget and you expect, you know, 50 million people to double in income over 20 years and none of them do, that would also be a problem. But that's all.
Well, again, go ahead, Prescott.
Yeah, that's absolutely right from a couple, but I think from two perspectives. I'm sorry if I'm missing something. One perspective is that the government's income depends on the income of the people. So if we have less economic growth overall, leaving aside the question of inequality, if you have less income growth in the country, you're going to have less revenue for the government, which means less money to pay for spending commitments that you've made in the past. But then I think the other reason that matters is that at the same time, there will be a greater need for government services than there would have been had those people made more money. So, for example, we know that in this recession, more people go on Medicaid and more people go on Social Security disability, and both of those things increase the deficit.
We have perhaps about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus, and our guest is James Kwok. He is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Connecticut School of Law and is the co-author with Simon Johnson of the recent book White House Burning. It's about the national debt. Pantheon is the publisher. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I'm not sure how many people are really excited about the idea of paying taxes. But if they're not, I'm sure that it has something to do with their feeling that the government is picking their pocket and they're not getting anything out of it. And I guess I'm very struck by the kind of numbers that you report in the book, and perhaps people have heard this kind of thing, that, for example, 44% of the people who receive Social Security say that they don't use a government program. 40% of people who get Medicare and 43% of people who are receiving unemployment benefits say the same thing. So how is it that we have a, I mean, one can certainly argue about taxes and one can argue about government spending, but how is it that we have people that are so poorly informed or willfully deceiving themselves about what government is actually doing for them?
Yeah, this is an interesting question. These numbers come from a survey done by Suzanne Mettler, who's a political scientist. And so just to put it in context, what they did is firstly asked people, do you benefit from a government social program? And most people said no. And then after them, they asked, do you participate in Social Security? Do you participate in Medicare? And so on. So there might be some amount of just cognitive dysfunction along the lines of, you know, keep your government hands off my Medicare. But I think what's more common is that people, although if you press them, they will admit that Social Security is a government program. I mean, the checks say U.S. Treasury on them. People don't think of that as a government program because people have this other conception of government. I think they have this conception of government. The government is the FBI, it's the EPA, it's the military, it's the air traffic controllers. Actually, I'm sorry, I don't know if they're a government anymore. It's these agencies that do stuff, or it's alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. Mm-hmm. And people think of Social Security and Medicare as a right, as an entitlement, and that exists somehow abstracted from the government. And that, I think, is what fuels a lot of people's, in a sense, split personality when it comes to the federal government. Because we know another way that this manifests itself is we know that if you ask people how to reduce the deficit, about half say it should be just spending cuts. And about half say it should be spending cuts and tax increases. Almost no one says just tax increases. But then if your next question is, should we make significant cuts to Medicare? They say no. Should we make significant cuts to Social Security? They say no. Amazingly, if you even say, should we make significant cuts to spending on culture and the arts? They still say no. So people are able in their heads at the same time to think the government is a waste and should not spend any more money. And at the same time, they can think that I like all the things the government does. And this is, you know, I'm not saying that this is something we should blame people for, because it's, you know, people have better things to do than worry about the federal budget and know, you know, what percentage of the budget is Medicare and what percentage is Social Security. But I would say that our media and our political class have essentially allowed this disconnect to persist by continually singling out, you know, things like the EPA as government without pointing out that Social Security and Medicare, these are government too.
Let's talk with another caller here in Champaign. They're next. It's line number one. Hello.
Hello. I was struck by the comment about the survey that was, you know, have you participated in Medicare or have you participated in Social Security? Mostly because if I was taking that survey, you know, I see my paycheck and I see that that's taken out. And so I would have marked I participate in it, even though I'm not yet receiving benefits for it. Also, the speaker's comment is very insightful. I am in the military as well, and honestly, I would not have considered that a government program. But yeah, obviously it is. So I want to make that comment and see what he has to say. But thank you very much.
All right, sure.
Good program.
It's nice to say that. I think that's very insightful of you to say. I mean, we think of the military. You know, even people who would think it should be a little smaller, most people think of the military as just something that has to be there and just, you know, it's part of the world. And hence they don't think of it as a government program. I think your point about Social Security and Medicare taxes coming out of your paycheck brings up a very important point. I'm not sure this is what you were thinking of, but I'll go there anywhere. Anyway, a lot of times people think of Social Security and Medicare in particular as a transfer of wealth from the, you know, from working age people the elderly. And in one sense, that's obviously true. I mean, working-age people pay taxes and the elderly collect benefits. But another way to look at it is essentially to think of it as an insurance or a risk pooling program, so that all of us are participating in these programs throughout our entire adult lives, so essentially from the age of 25 until, or 18, until 65, you are paying in, and from 65 on, you are getting benefits back out. And if you look at it that way, I think Social Security and Medicare, it really does make sense if you're in your 20s to think of yourselves as participating in these programs, because what are they doing for you? They are essentially insuring you against some long-term risks. If you think about Social Security is a modestly progressive program. So what that means is that as your lifetime income increases, your benefits don't increase as fast. They do increase modestly. So what Social Security is really doing, if you're 25 years old, you don't know how much money you're going to make in the next 40 years. And the program is allowing you to hedge your risk by shifting money from the future states of the world in which you have a lot of money, shifting it from those states into the future states where you don't have a lot of money. And that's a very useful program. So I think that it definitely makes sense for young people to think of themselves as participating in the program. Now, at the same time, we have to recognize that right now the numbers don't add up. The amount of money going in, under current law, the amount of money coming in from working age people is not going to pay for the benefits going out to the elderly indefinitely, and that is something that needs to be fixed.
Well, again, we have maybe about 6 or 7 minutes. I have some other callers. We'll just keep going and talking with folks. We'll go to another Champaign person. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to bring up two points, a little bit tangential, but I think indicative of what people's attitudes towards government. One issue is, of course, the fiction about Social Security that used to be spoken of more commonly was that there was some sort of Social Security lockbox and the money you put in was somehow sequestered, etc., whereas in reality, of course, no such thing, and it essentially was used by the government for all sorts of purposes, and people, I think there's certain resentment about that, if nothing else. But that sort of leads to the second point, is the sense that government officials essentially benefit and raid the government funds for all sorts of programs that they benefit from, whether it's things like, well, the state of Illinois, we're well known for all the ways our political officials have manipulated the system so that they and their friends get enormous pensions, et cetera, or even things like the uproar about Defense Secretary Panetta flying back and forth to California every weekend and sticking the taxpayers for, at this point, I think it was about $800,000 in expenses rather than taking commercial flights. And this is just in the last, I think, 10 months or so. So it's the sense of self-aggrandizement and self-entitlement that politicians use the federal government and the state government's money that really, I think, is causes a lot of resentment. I know this is somewhat tangential, but maybe you can connect to those points. Thank you.
All right.
That's a very good point, I think. I've been talking about the government a bit in the abstract, you know, as a set of programs that people benefit from. And I think that the caller makes a very good point, which is that the government is led by a set of elected officials who have many failings, to put it modestly. And I think that that definitely does lead to a degree of deserved resentment of Washington and of the federal government. I think it's you know, increasingly clear that the decisions of politicians in Washington are driven, I would say, first by the interests of their, you know, essentially their investors, so the wealthy people and corporations that they flow campaigns, and then secondly, I would say, by their own personal interests, and that, you know, has created it has deepened the disillusionment that many people feel with the federal government, and I don't want to deny that either that that happens or that the disillusionment has a basis. I would say that it's possible to take that resentment too far, right? It's possible to say, well, the federal government is run by a bunch of crooks, so I don't want to give it any money. I think we should just shut the whole thing down. You know, we should have the border police and we should have the military and that's it. And I think at that point, most middle-class people would really just be hurting themselves because the government is imperfect. There's a lot of stupid things. But, you know, just to repeat the point I've made, you know, over and over, think about Medicare. You know, if you're 25 years old, there's no way you could buy a health insurance policy. You could pay money for the next 40 years that would buy a policy that would cover you from age 65 until the time you die. The private market could not have such a product because no private company can afford to take on risks 40 years into the future. So I think there are good things that the government does, and the government has a lot of problems. But it would be a mistake to allow our, let's say, our personal feelings about some of the politicians in Washington to dictate our policy preferences for what we should get out of the government.
All right. Let's go again to line number three. This is another Champaign listener. Hello. Line three. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes.
So the first thing is that I wanted to applaud you in how you look at both Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security. And what I would add to that is that people call these entitlement programs, but the only reason they're entitlement programs is because those of us who draw from them are entitled to them because we've paid into them for a long, long time. But I've got two points that I wanted to make, and this concerns the current debt problem. And I've heard a lot of people talk about borrowing and how money is so cheap to borrow. I've never heard anybody talk about paying back. And so the issue is less egregious if you think, well, we borrowed from ourselves, so we have to pay back to ourselves, so we'll just print more money. But it's more egregious when we think that we are now borrowing, or we have been borrowing, from outside sources. That is, China is now the bank. And let's say that, as you pointed out, when things get a little bit tight for China, let's say they want to start redeeming the bonds, right? So the question is, given our spending proclivities, how do you propose that we pay back China in the long run when China wants to be paid back? Rolling them over won't work. Right. So the second point is that the thing that I worry about government, the federal government, is that they don't know how not to spend. They just love to continue to develop new programs and to spend on these new programs, even though they may not constitute a huge portion of the budget, which, of course, the major portions of the budget are defense, Medicare, and Social Security. So I'll hang up and listen to your comments, and thank you very much. It's okay. Been a great program.
Well, thank Bye-bye. You. And we are coming down to we have about 2 minutes, so I realize that's not very much time maybe to deal fully with these questions, but do what you can.
We'll give it a shot. I mean, so for China, I think you've hit the point on the head. I mean, there is going to be a point when foreign appetite for Treasury debt is going to decline, and at that point, we're going to have to start paying, redeeming some bonds instead of just rolling them over. I hope I'm not missing anything by saying simply that what we're going to need to do is we're going to need to run budget surpluses in the future, and that's going to mean either spending cuts or tax increases. And essentially, Chapter 7 of the book tries to outline a set of proposals that we could implement that would fill that gap. And some of it is straight tax increases, some of it is straight spending cuts. A lot of it is this category that a lot of, you know, policy nerds like me are interested in, which is closing tax loopholes, essentially, like reducing the home mortgage interest deduction, reducing the deduction of charitable contributions, and so on. These are policies that I think would be good economically and would bring in revenue. But that is what we're going to have to do. I'm sorry, can you remind me, David, the second question?
Well, I think that I'm not sure quite how you respond to this, but the concern of the caller is that no matter what, the government really only knows how to do one thing, that's to spend, and it doesn't really know how not to spend. So
this is a political issue that, you know, people have noted for a long time, which is that if you want to be reelected, you know, the best ways to buy reelection are spending on your constituents and tax cuts. That is, you know, that is a legitimate concern, I think, with the government. I think that in recent history, it's actually has not been the driver, however, of our increasing deficits. For the most part, as he noted, what's been growing has been the entitlement programs and defense, and discretionary spending. This category you mentioned at the top has been in a long-term decline since the 1970s, or non-defense discretionary spending. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I mean, the problem of earmarks is with us, but it's not the driving factor in the debt issue today.
Well, we're almost at the point we have to finish. I people sometimes are critical of the Republicans because they say that they're definitely not for tax increases. They want to cut taxes, but they do also want to cut spending, at least for those things that they don't want to spend money on. I think, though, on the other side of the aisle, I'm not sure that Democrats are any more excited about raising taxes than Republicans are. I mean, how do you get people in the frame of mind politically to actually think about what they can do to increase revenue?
Well, I think it's very difficult. And on the Republican side in particular, the party is essentially handcuffed by the Taxpayer Protection Pledge, the pledge not to increase tax revenues or to increase marginal tax rates, which if you think about it, it's a fantastic negotiating device, right? When you go into a negotiation, the best thing possible is to be unable to concede. So I'm not, you know, to be honest, I'm not optimistic. I'm optimistic. Well, I think two things could help. One is that if we have enough gridlock, the Bush tax cuts will expire. And while that might not be ideal for the economy, I would prefer a temporary tax cut, et cetera. That would be a major step toward solving the long-term deficit problem. The other solution, which is not a pretty one, is that at some point, again, I'm not predicting when, if people don't want to buy Treasury bonds, if interest rates start going up, then that is going to create a much greater sense of urgency than we're seeing today.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest, James Kwok, he is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Connecticut School of Law and is the co-author, along with Simon Johnson, of the new book, White House Burning. The subtitle is The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. Pantheon is the publisher. Professor Kwok, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Support comes from the Illinois Symphony Orchestra in Titanic and Terrific, with pianist Adam Neiman in Ravel's Piano Concerto, and Mahler's First Symphony with guest conductor Kenneth Raskin, May 4th at Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, and May 5th at Sangamon Auditorium in Springfield. Details at ilsymphony.org.
That's it for us on Focus this morning. Up next is the Afternoon Magazine. Craig Cohen is the host.
Thank you very much, David. And yes, we have a lot in store ahead on the Afternoon Magazine news from NPR, the BBC, and WILL as well, including details on a second investigation by Champaign police of the pepper spraying and arrest of a young African-American man That investigation has found that those actions were reasonable, but that his treatment while held in a squad car was not. That includes a moment when the complainant was pushed on his neck in order to get him to leave the car. We'll have all the details for you. That's ahead on the Afternoon Magazine. Let's take a look at the commodity markets at this hour. Winter wheat, May winter wheat is at 6:30, down 15.5. July winter wheat at 6:35.5, down 21.5. September winter wheat at 6:51.25, down 21.25. May wheat 6:17.5, down 16.25. July wheat at 6:23, down 20. May corn 6:46, down 13.75. July corn at 6:13.25, down 15.75. September corn 5:41.75, down 8.5. May soybeans at 1492, down 5.75.